The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists and contributors, and now our live events are bringing that community even closer.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and join the debates on the big issues of our time. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, John Irving, in conversation with Jeanette Winterson, was recorded at the Whitworth Art Gallery, Manchester, in January 2016. Here's the host, the writer, Jeanette Winterson.
This is very exciting. It's a great pleasure and a privilege for me to be able to talk to John Irving tonight about this book, Avenue of Mysteries, because I love his work and I've loved it for years. And one of the great things that you get when you're a writer is that sometimes you just get a gig that you want to do, you know, with somebody you haven't met and that you admire, you know, and whose work is there, part of your private library, you know, the things that you carry inside you, as well as the things that are on the shelves. So this is a wonderful thing. And John is going to talk about the book. We're going to talk around the other books that he's written, ideas about writing, ideas about what it means to be a writer in a world like ours, what our responsibilities might be, our entertainment value and our moral purpose. Big questions. But we're going to start with a reading from Avenue of Mysteries, and John will explain what he's going to read and really open the book out for you.
I just want to echo what Jeanette says. This is the first time I've met her, and I've always read her books and liked them. And I almost wrote her a letter and thanked her for the best review anyone wrote of in one person. But I hoped I would have that opportunity to tell you thanks. Well, unless I'm forgetting something, I don't think I have to tell you anything about this little reading because it introduces the children who are the principal or most important focus of this novel. Juan Diego, who is 14, and his sister Lupe, who's 13. It introduces their circumstances in Oaxaca, in southern Mexico, where they come from, which is the first thing in this novel you, I think, need to know. In Oaxaca, he was what they called a dump kid, un niño de la basura, a child of the rubbish. He lived in a shack in Guerrero, the colony for families who worked in the dump, El Basurero. In 1970, there were only 10 families living in Guerrero. At that time, about 100,000 people lived in the city of Oaxaca. Many of them didn't know that the dump kids did most of the picking and sorting through the stuff at the Basurero. The children had the job of separating the glass, the aluminum, the copper. People who knew what the dump kids did called them Los Papenadores, the scavengers. At 14, that was who Juan Diego was, a dump kid and a scavenger. But the boy was also a reader. The word got around that un niño de la basura had taught himself to read. That was how the Jesuits, who put such a high priority on education, heard about the boy from Guerrero. The two old Jesuit priests at the Temple of the Society of Jesus referred to Juan Diego as the dump reader. Someone should bring the dump reader a good book or two. God knows what the boy finds to read in the Basurero, either Father Alfonso or Father Octavio said. Whenever one of those two old priests said someone should do anything, Brother Pepe was always the one who did it. In the first place, Pepe had a car. And because he'd come from Mexico City, getting around Oaxaca was relatively easy for him. Pepe was a teacher at the Jesuit school. It had long been a successful school. Everyone knew the Society of Jesus was good at running schools. On the other hand, the Jesuit orphanage was relatively new. It had been less than 10 years since they'd remodeled the former convent as an orphanage, and not everyone was crazy about the orphanage's name. To some, Hogar de los Niños Perdidos was a long name that sounded a little severe. But Brother Pepe had put his heart into the school and the orphanage. Over time, most of those tender souls who objected to the sound of Home of the Lost Children would certainly admit that the Jesuits ran a pretty good orphanage, too. Besides, everyone had already shortened the name of the place. Lost Children, people called it. One of the nuns who looked after the children was more blunt about it. To be fair, Sister Gloria must have been referring to a couple of misbehaving kids, not to all the orphans, when she muttered occasionally, Los Perdidos, the Lost Ones, surely was a name the old nun intended for only a few of the more exasperating children. Luckily, it was not Sister Gloria who brought the books to the Basurero for the young dump reader. If Gloria had chosen the books and been their deliverer, Juan Diego's story might have ended before it began. But Brother Pepe put reading on a pedestal. He was a Jesuit because the Jesuits had made him a reader and introduced him to Jesus, not necessarily in that order. It was best not to ask Pepe if reading or Jesus had saved him, or which one had saved him more. But Brother Pepe had never been to the Oaxaca Basurero before. In those days, they burned everything they could in the dump. There were fires everywhere. Books were useful fire starters. When Pepe stepped out of his VW Beetle, the smell of the Basurero and the heat of the fires were what he'd imagined hell would be like, only he hadn't imagined children working there. There were some very good books in the back seat of the little Volkswagen. Good books were the best protection from evil that Pepe had actually held in his hands. You could not hold faith in Jesus in your hands. Not in quite the same way you could hold good books. I'm looking for the reader, Pepe told the dump workers, both the adults and the children. Los Pepenadores, the scavengers, gave Pepe a look full of contempt. It was evident that they did not value reading. One of the adults spoke first, a woman, perhaps Pepe's age or a little younger, probably the mother of one or more of the scavengers. She told Pepe to look for Juan Diego in Guerrero, in El Jefe's shack. Brother Pepe was confused. Maybe he'd misunderstood her. El Jefe was the dump boss. He was the head of the Basurero. Was the reader El Jefe's child? Pepe asked the woman worker. Several dump kids laughed. Then they turned away. The adults didn't think it was funny. And the woman said only, not exactly. She pointed in the direction of Guerrero, which was nestled into a hillside below the Basurero. The shacks in the colony had been assembled from materials the workers had found in the dump, and El Jefe's shack was the one at the periphery of the colony, at the edge nearest the dump. Black columns of smoke stood high above the Basurero, pillars of blackness reaching into the sky. Vultures circled overhead. But Pepe saw there were carrion eaters above and below. Dogs were everywhere in the Basurero, skirting the hellfires and grudgingly giving ground to the men in trucks, but to almost no one else. The dogs were uneasy company around the children. Both were scavenging, if not for the same stuff. The dogs weren't interested in glass or aluminum or copper. The dump dogs were mostly strays, of course, and some were dying. Pepe wouldn't be in the Basurero long enough to spot the dead dogs or to see what became of them. They were burned, but not always before the vultures found them. In the midst of all the burning, Pepe had this thought. Most dump kids are believers. Maybe you have to believe in something when you see so many discarded things. And Juan Diego knew what every dump kid and every orphan knows. Every last thing thrown away, every person or thing that isn't wanted, may have been wanted once, or in different circumstances, might have been wanted. The dump reader had saved books from burning, and he'd actually read the books. Don't ever think a dump reader is incapable of belief. It takes an eternity to read some books, even, or especially, books saved from burning.
You're all going to buy this book now, as you want to know what happens next. But in fact, we don't really meet Juan Diego as a grown man until about 40 years later, is that right? When he's making a pilgrimage of sorts, I guess.
It is a pilgrimage, I think.
Yes, though I'm not sure he entirely understands that, or indeed how it will end or what its purpose will be. So it is a quest story in many ways, I think. And you've even wounded him. You know, Harry Potter has a scar. So you've got a wounded man, because what happens to Juan Diego is his foot gets run over when he's about 14, and from then on he walks with a limp, doesn't he?
Well, he's the second of my major characters in novels to have a limp. There were others, you know, who lost other parts of themselves. So I seem to do that to people in a kind of clumsy version of Dickens by marking them with an indelible reminder of how they were wounded, as you say, or crippled in more than one way. Damaged is perhaps, but I think Juan Diego has been damaged more by what happens to him and principally to his sister than he was by the garbage truck that runs over his foot. But the foot is a good way to mark him.
Mm. And it's a visible reminder that he is separated out, even when he's successful and admired, and he's entered into a different kind of life, a different kind of society. I don't know what you think about wounds and how we work with wounds, because writers always do, don't we? I mean, it's the place you talk about. You say, look, I don't write about my life. I write about what I fear, and those fears are always places where we've been wounded, and the things that will not go away, that won't heal over, but you work from them, I guess.
They're, and if not the places we ourselves are wounded, the things we hope never happens to someone, to anyone we love. I seem to write most obsessively about that. I don't think it's an accident, for example, that in many, if not most of the novels, something happens to a person at a arguably most formative age, right around the threshold of or doorstep to the puberty years. Between age 12 and 15, it's common in my novels for something to happen to a young person in that passage between childhood and becoming an adult, that not only is life changing and life lasting, but to a further extent makes them the adult they will become.
Or in the case of Lupe, the adult they won't become.
Or they won't become,
that
exactly.
That wounding is very drastic, isn't it? Lupe is Juan Diego's younger sister, and she's clairvoyant.
Yes.
But she's not so good at reading the future, but she's really good at reading the past and people's minds. And it's very funny, because she speaks a kind of Spanish that nobody except her brother can understand. So she says the most terrible things in company, and Juan Diego has to decide whether he'll translate it or not.
Or whether he'll make her remarks seem so meek and mild that they don't sound like her.
And there's a lot of very funny exchanges with the Jesuits where they won't be saying, what's she saying? And he will say something completely different. Not, you know, you're a penis breath, for instance.
Yes.
So there are issues there. But Lupe, puberty, I mean, she's not wounded. She's eaten by a lion. I mean,
yeah,
that's the end of that, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think whatever happens isn't going to develop further. But it seems a kind of benign sacrifice, because if I read it right, it's almost a choice she makes, because she has this time seen the future right.
It is a choice she makes, though she's quite an innocent to make a choice of that kind. And one of the reasons I made her judgment of the future flawed, or at least in her brother's estimation, not always so good as her understanding of what has happened to you in the past, is that I think a part of not knowing what she meant, a part of not knowing the details of the future she thought she saw and hoped to change, is what haunts Juan Diego as an older man. It even haunts the doctor, Vargas, the atheist, who, in some kind of intellectual academic vanity, keeps exploring the ramifications of rabies in lions long after the subject of rabies in lions or not could possibly have done Lupe any good. I like this character because of how much she kind of gets into the minds of the people she leaves behind.
And the idea that life might have been different, that these small shifts and changes, if one door hadn't opened, if another door hadn't closed, that the whole thing would have been different. And looking back on that and knowing that you can't change it, but perhaps in some ways you wish that you could. I mean, by this point, Lupe and Juan Diego don't even have a mother. They don't know who their father is, and their mother has died in the most terrible circumstances, dusting a giant Virgin Mary.
Yes.
In a monster Mary. This is really one of the funniest parts. There's a running trope through the book, and it is Marx Brothers. It's such fun. This statue, she's enormous. She's like the Statue of Liberty, isn't she? This monster Mary.
She's preternaturally large.
did you make her bigger than anything you've ever actually seen, even in Mexico?
Actually, that particular statue of that particular Virgin Mary in the Jesuit temple in Oaxaca is as big as I describe. It's she's gargantuan, and one of the first things I thought when I saw her was absurdly practical. I thought, how does anyone clean that? Which, of course, led me to the death of the mother. The answer is a very long ladder. And what can you lean the ladder against? Well, there's nothing around the Virgin Mary. So the problem is when you clean her, and I went to some lengths to see this happen. there's nowhere to lean the ladder but against her, which surely some part of her would disapprove of. It's not something you should do to a holy statue, is it? But you can't really take care of her forehead or the top of her head if you don't put the ladder somewhere.
So the kid's mother's up there dusting.
It's a kind of inherently disrespectful problem. So I instantly was drawn to it.
And it gives rise to a part of the book that's very funny, but also in the end very tragic and moving, because the poor old mother, trying to save herself, grabs hold of the Virgin's nose, doesn't she?
Yes, or hits it with the dust sweep. It's
and off it comes.
Yeah.
So now the Virgin has no nose, which, you know, from the Jesuits' point of view, is a crisis.
But it only somehow contributes to her severity, being noseless. It gives her an even more judgmental aspect, I think, until there is the miracle of the new nose.
Because this is the religion is, it saturates this book. I mean, it's fiercely there, and it's not. Although you're always very good at making fun of religion, which we have to, it's not. You know, there's nothing about this, nothing about the way you talk about it, in which is undermining in that sense. And it's also ambiguous, because we do wonder: did this miracle happen? And are these feelings real? Are these, you know, the religious sensibility? It's not just a satire, is it?
I hope not, because it seems to me the story doesn't... It's just not credible. If children from this background don't want to believe, don't seek to believe in the miracles, which are the magic, not just the Roman Catholic Church is based on, but there is a comparable kind of magic or mystery or miracle at the heart of most of the world's great religions. And I wanted to make the point that Juan Diego and Lupe, even as children, are very doubtful of the man-made institution which is the Catholic Church and its spokespersons. They're very doubtful of the rules, of the policies, of the interpretations. And Juan Diego, as an older man, will be consistently provoked by the church's attitude toward sexual minorities, toward abortion. All of these things that are easy to find fault with don't, however, explain, as the old dump boss says when we last see him leaving the temple, and the Virgin Mary, this Virgin Mary, has actually delivered. She's actually come through with a bit of a miracle or something that is at least inexplicable, even to the two old priests. And the old dump boss, pointing to the giant Virgin Mary, but speaking to the old priest, says, "I come here for her, not for you." Well, you can't be around the life of a church, a mosque, a synagogue, very much, and watch the people come and go at all hours of the day and night. Whenever it's open, someone is there. And not realize, I think, that the foundation of faith isn't these man-made institutions, aren't these vexing and irksome to most of us rules and regulations that are so lacking in progressiveness, so far behind the way people actually live. Again, speaking not exclusively of the Roman Catholic Church. But you can't be around such a place and not see the people who come there to pray, to ask for help. I'm not speaking about their presence at the ceremonies. I'm speaking about their presence in the empty mosque, the empty synagogue, the empty church, which is never empty.
And I think it's important that you do talk about this, because, you know, the state the world's in now, it's very difficult for anybody who is secular, lives in a particular way in the West, to understand the motive, the urge, the sensibility that lies behind wanting to believe. Wanting to have faith. And I think that partly the reason the dialogue's breaking down is that we can't get at the feeling behind it, because we're always trying to intellectualise it and say, this is ridiculous, this is rubbish, how can anyone believe in this? It shouldn't be so. But when you see active faith happening in communities, and particularly poor communities, you have to stop analysing and just look at it. And this is, you know, novels are great at that. You know, they're great at getting away from the judgments and into the feeling tone that allows things to happen. And that's what this book does.
That's very true. And I think the other... Because whatever I write is always ending-driven by what I want to happen at the end of a story. And I went looking for the miracle it would take to make a human action take place for the purposes of my characters and my story. In other words, I have Juan Diego, an orphan. The Jesuits own him. He belongs to the orphanage. He is an orphan. His mother is dead. His father, if Rivera really is his father, has not stepped forward and claimed him. And only two people want him. A homosexual man who has just failed to become a priest, and that homosexual man's transvestite lover, formerly a prostitute. So the question I ask myself is, in Mexico in 1970, come on, in Mexico today, forget about 1970, what will it take to compel these two old Jesuit priests who control this boy's future to ever put this 14-year-old into the hands of those two? Well, that's when you need a miracle. Because the answer is, they're never going to do it. Unless what? Unless the Virgin Mary herself sheds tears, and they just wish that would go away. And
I mean, I love the way you do that. That they're then so terrified this is going to become the site of pilgrimage, be investigated as a new spiritual happening, that they're desperate for it to be covered up, and they'd rather give the kid, you know, to a transsexual and homosexual than have a site of miracle in the church. That's the Catholic hierarchy for you.
Well, so in other words, if the miracle's big enough, it will even surmount the sexual discrimination of the church. But that's going to take a big miracle.
But it's a beautiful relationship, the relationship between Edward Bonshaw, the failed would-be Jesuit, and Floor, the transsexual prostitute. It's the most touching and enduring relationship in the book. And I mean, you've done this before, because you've always been ahead of your time in looking at relationships which are on the outside, and not only making them central, but also showing how they expose what are the norms of society and our own prejudices and assumptions. You know, there's a beautiful speech towards the end where Juan Diego is talking to a guy who's bullied him at school, and suddenly 30 years later this red-faced, loud-mouthed boor is in a restaurant shouting at his daughter. And Juan Diego thinks, I know that voice, I know that guy, I know that tone of phrase. And he makes this marvellous speech about Edward Bonshaw and about Floor, when they both were HIV positive and he was taken to the hospital every day, how much he loved them, that he used to shave Floor when she could no longer take her medication, her estrogen, so her beard came back. and that perhaps he thought he'd never marry because these two people had the greatest love affair that he had ever met and were the most devoted, the most passionate, the most considerate and the most caring of him. It's him to love. Love in any place you find it, but love that is real. It is so beautiful. Why do you do that?
Well, I'm so glad you liked it. It was also their deaths and what they matter to him, to the older Juan Diego. I wanted to make the point that what happens to this man as a child, as a young adolescent, just leaving childhood, as a 14-year-old, what happens to him is so devastating that when we meet him 40 years later, and the novel begins by our meeting him 40 years later, we meet him first as an older man. He is living much more vividly as a 14-year-old in his dreams and in his memories than he appears to be even sufficiently cognizant of his life as an adult. And although he has lived from the day he left Mexico at age 14, and although he has lived for 40 years in the U.S. and is, much to his dislike, a Mexican-American, so-called, that's who he is. There's only one chapter, and you mentioned it, there's only one chapter in this book that's about Juan Diego's life in the United States, and it is the chapter about the deaths of these two gay men who've adopted him and who love him and whom he loves. It's about their death, which is why it's a whole chapter. There's nothing else in Juan Diego's 40 years in the United States that carries the gravity, the vividness, even, of what happened to him as a 14-year-old when he loses his sister. That was always the scheme of the book. That was always the book's architecture, the novel's sort of construction rules, that in the back and forth telling between the 14-year-old and the 54-year-old making, as you called it, this pilgrimage to the Philippines, between those two stories, which won't catch up to one another until he's in Manila.
But this pilgrimage is attended by a number of perhaps supernatural events, isn't it? Because there are two mysterious women.
Well, certainly not natural.
No, not natural. They're not
certainly
natural.
Certainly not natural.
I don't know what we're meant to think. Perhaps we're not. We're just meant to experience it, not to explain it. But there are two women in here, Dorothy and Miriam, who are beginners, the most typical annoying, pushy. Reading women, the groupies kinds that suddenly turn up at airports and try and fix everything for you when you're in the lounge and you just want to be left on your own. Dorothy and Miriam then seem to be around Juan Diego continually, appearing and disappearing. We don't quite know anything about them, except that he has sex with both of them, not at the same time, but separately. But it becomes more likely as we read on that these are not ordinary women at all. And indeed, you've said that you have to know the end of the novel before you can even start. So without doing a spoiler alert, you must have known at the end that your hero was going to die. Yes. And that he would be attended at that death, mysteriously.
Yes.
By these women who are by now shrouded in black and appear to be bringing him across the threshold.
Yes.
What was all that about? I mean, I love it. I love it that they come and have sex with him. You know, what, they make him take his whole tablet of Viagra. which is wonderful. He has a wonderful time. They do look after him. But who are they? He wakes up in bed a couple of times, doesn't he, with one or both of them, and saying, who are you? And his question is not answered, and we can't answer it either. And then they vanish. Nobody sees them come. Nobody sees them go. Who are they?
Well, there's a moment in his childhood when Rivera, the dump boss, has just backed over his foot. And Rivera, who Lupe disparagingly at the time calls a Mary worshipper, which she disapproves of. She calls herself a Guadalupe girl, one of the other virgins you see in Mexican churches. Rivera carries Juan Diego, screaming in pain, to the feet of the giant virgin in the Jesuit temple, hoping for a quick fix, hoping for a cure to the crushed foot. It's pretty evident that it's not going to happen. As Lupe puts it, the virgins aren't working today. But Rivera is hoping for the best. And that at that moment when he's in so much pain and screaming, there's just a second when his pain abates. When you're in that kind of severe pain, it can, but it'll come back again in a hurry. And in that second when the pain vanishes, he sees in one of the frontmost pews of the temple two women with their heads covered, all in black, apparent mourners. We don't know what they're doing there. You see mourners frequently. In a church, they could be there on the 10th anniversary of someone's death. They could be there because someone's died recently. But they're clearly mourning someone and praying for the soul of someone. And the second he sees them, the pain is back. He's screaming again. And just before the onset of the pain, he thinks, in that half second, he's pain-free. Maybe I've died. Maybe they're mourning me. Maybe that's who they are. And then when the pain comes back, he's relieved and thinks, well, no, I'm not dying. I'm going to be okay. And when he looks again, whoever they were, those two women have vanished. Well, I thought in his later life, when he's 40 and is going to the Philippines to keep a promise, an absurd promise, he made to a draft dodger in a bathtub when he, Juan Diego, was only 14. I thought that one of the reasons I wanted him to make that trip was that they would come with him. The attendant spirits who had not been able to usher his passage into the next world, if that's what they're doing, they've just been biding their time.
I love the idea that you can have an attendant spirit who'll also have sex with you.
Yes, but you and I were talking backstage about writing about writers, and certainly one of the primary reasons I wanted to make Juan Diego a writer, in addition to making him a lonely and sexually inexperienced man, was that I think you have to be someone who's living more in your imagination or in the past, in your memories, in your dreams, than you are in the real world around you, to ever be so foolish as to sleep with a mother and her daughter. That's the kind of stupid thing that only a writer could do. You really have to have your head somewhere else to think that that's going to be okay. That there aren't going to be perhaps some serious repercussions of that. That's a close to Oedipus mistake there. Most of us would, I hope, think twice. Just for propriety's sake, choose one, for God's sake. You know, you're asking for... This is one of those, I think, asking for trouble situations. Well, I keep saying I did this before. Well, I did this before with Ruth Cole in A Widow for 1 Year, who I also made a writer because she has to do something that's also very ill-advised. I wanted her, because of something she wants to write, she wants to see a prostitute with the prostitute's client. She wants to see the prostitute and the customer together. Well, I did a lot of research speaking to prostitutes in the red light district of Amsterdam, asking them how often they'd ever been approached by someone who said, I'll pay you to conceal me and let me watch you with the customer. To my surprise, many more times than I would have guessed. Not to my surprise, never was it a woman. And I said to most of them, aha, but she wasn't a writer. A woman who's a writer could get herself in trouble. Other women would probably know better.
Give me a good idea then.
Be careful.
But women do well in your books. You like women, you write well about women, your women characters are real. I mean, you know, this doesn't happen with every male writer, let's be honest, as we're among friends tonight. But you're very appreciative of what you call women readers. You say it's women who are reading and it's women who are carrying fiction.
But don't you think that's true?
I do.
For every writer, don't you think that for every writer who's writing fiction, at least, I don't mean necessarily thriller fiction. I don't mean necessarily crime fiction
I do. There was
Armageddon
a survey in GQ saying that only 11% of men read fiction. Not 11% of all.
You know, it's getting harder to do surveys on airplanes and in subways now because people are reading more things electronically, if they're reading at all. So you can't always see the book they're reading, but it's evident to me that Ian McEwan has said the same thing, that it's women, for the most part, who read or maintain an interest after the university years in literary fiction. And if it's a university-age person, I find that good fiction appears in the hands of men and women equally. But something happens to the boys when they're over 30. They start reading golf books or nonfiction or something. You know, or if they are reading fiction, it's not good stuff. I don't know what happens to them, but the older women seem to keep their imagination alive. I have to control myself sometimes when I see a man, that is a grown man, reading a good novel. I don't want to give him the wrong idea by hugging him and saying, thank you very much. But it is unusual, and usually, you know, if you're in an airport waiting for your bag at a carousel and there's a guy coming up to me, I think, oh, what's this about? And he says, you're John Irving, aren't you? Uh-huh. Yeah, I say. And he always says, you're my wife's favorite writer. You know, you're my mother's favorite writer. The only exception I can think of that was I once had the thrill to me, because I'm a cook, of meeting Julia Child. I'd read all her books, and And I met her in a grocery store, and I was jumping to try and reach a box of cereal, which was out of my reach because I'm really short. And there she was, towering over me, saying, "Oh, may I help you with that?" in her cooking voice, and I knew immediately who she was. And she asked me what I did, that I read all her cookbooks. I said, "Well, I cook, but I also write." "Oh, what?" she said, and I told her what I wrote, and nothing like this has ever happened since. She said, "Oh, my husband reads you." So, okay, but that's a one and only, you know.
Yeah. I mean, when, it's true. I think it is women, and it's not just when you're a woman writer. You know, there used to be a myth at one point that if your audience was full of women, it's because you're a woman writer. So then the guys would come up, and they do say, "This is, you know, this is my girlfriend," or "This is for my daughter." You know, "It's not for me." You know, go. But it's, I think whoever you are, male or female, as a writer, your audience is going to be usually at least 2/3 female now, isn't it?
100%.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've got an interesting backlash at the moment. I mean, Marlon James, who I like, and I did a conversation with him in Miami, is driving me nuts at the minute because he's wandering around saying that writers mustn't pander to the white woman. And you think, what do you... No, don't say that. And in any case, if it's the, you know, if it's the woman of whatever colour who's reading your books, pander to her.
I say yes, that's a good idea.
I think it's a good idea. Yeah. Do you like writing women in your characters? Do you feel... Do you just go into that place very easily? You don't think, oh, this is a woman now. Is it just smooth for you? Or is there any moment where you think, now I am writing as a woman or about a woman? Or I'm warning you, I'm going to ask you about Jenny Fields in a minute and Garp. Just so that you know where we're heading.
I don't... When I'm writing, I don't compartmentalize women as being in a... of a degree of difficulty that's different or separate from men. I used to feel challenged by older characters of either sex, but now that I am older, that's not a problem. So, I don't think about it. I don't think about it as a different situation. I think the truth is that because I pay so much attention to the deliberation I give to the construction of the story, the architecture, as I call it, it slows down whatever my process is so appreciably that I've generally lived with the characters, just gathering notes about them, profiling them very slowly over a long period of time while the particulars of the sequence of the storytelling kind of makes sense to me, that by the time I begin a novel, I feel I've lived with these characters and sometimes have for 8 or 10 years or more, and it will rarely take me more than 4 or 5 years to finish a novel once I start writing it. But that's always a little deceptive to say because the novels sit unwritten but largely formed. Waiting
for me to
give
them. And
you
said you have more than one cycling in your head at any one time that you might get drawn to.
That's true. I don't... Even if I have 2 or 3 novels that have been waiting a while that might be the next one, I try not, when I'm finishing a novel or a screenplay or whatever it is I'm writing at the moment, I try not to particularize among the things that are waiting which is going to be the next one until I'm ready to say, okay, now I have to decide which it is.
And might you have had characters, if you're, you know, characters are becoming people you know, but they're not yet in novels, might they go into...
Yes. Well, this novel is a particular case in point, because it for 20 years of its life, it was only a screenplay. Yeah. For 20 years of its life, I never intended this story as a novel. For as long as it was only about Juan Diego and Lupe at the ages of 14 and 13, it was a movie, and only a movie. One that began in India, in an Indian circus, in a Jesuit mission in Bombay, but with principally these same characters. The boy was always crippled. His sister was always younger, and she had a preternatural, disturbing gift of reading minds of people and of animals, and imagining at times that she also saw the future. It was essentially this story. And when that director and I failed to get that film made in India, and believed, I think on good evidence, that we never would, not our way, and we relocated the story to Mexico, it was one of those things born of a hardship that turned into a much better and more credible story. The Catholic Church has been vastly more successful, more dominant, more pervasive in Mexico, it goes without saying, than they've ever succeeded in India. The choices of virgins and churches that were presented to us in southern Mexico were uncountable. We also came upon the fact that today, as then, the children from deprived circumstances that we best like for our story should come from the basurero, should come from the dumps, because children are the principal dump workers in Mexico. And not least, I always wanted, even in the Mexican manifestation of the screenplay, I always wanted a sympathetic draft dodger. I always wanted the kind of older boy who 13 and 14-year-olds would look up to, be infatuated by, admire, but the reader or the audience would take one look at this runaway boy running away from the war in Vietnam and know that he was a really lost soul and a troubled kid who was not going to end up well. But I wanted that draft dodger, and it was always a stretch, even to my...
So he was living with you?
He was living with me, but...
Your wife's a very tolerant woman.
I just didn't really feel that I could make him credible enough. In other words, how a draft dodger gets to India in 1970, that's already a novel. That's already pushing the envelope, right? But it was easy in Mexico, especially after Nixon was elected in 68 on the promise that he would end the war in Vietnam, and didn't. Coming into the 70s, there were many more draft dodgers leaving the United States and going to those border countries, to Mexico and to Canada. El Gringo Bueno, as I call him, the good gringo, was a far more credible presence for me in the Mexican reincarnation of this screenplay.
So you're saying, just so that people don't get their hopes up, you've got an Oscar, should have brought it, for the Side House Rules, and you couldn't get your movie made.
Oh, that's not the only movie I haven't been able to get made.
Just so that you know.
And let me tell you, the Naked Gold Man is of no assistance to getting something new made.
Do you like writing for the movies, though? Is that a place that you can enjoy, or is it just torture?
Well, the question is well asked. You said, do I like writing for the movies? Mm. No, I do not like writing for the movies. Do I like writing screenplays? Yes, I do, occasionally. And I'm writing a teleplay right now, which is far more suitable for a novelist, because a miniseries, a five-episode miniseries, is close to the equivalent of 2.5 feature-length films, mm-hmm. which is a much more agreeable way for me to adapt something longer in film terms than feeling myself crowded into that coffin for a dog, which a feature-length film feels like if you're used to writing a novel.
So if you're giving advice to the screenplay people in the audience, because I know we've got quite a few, what would you be saying, look towards television?
Well,
you can give a short answer, you can say no.
Well, I have to say, and this feels like a betrayal of the thing I love best, which is the novel. But I mean, to be honest, if I were 23 instead of 73, I don't know if I'd write novels. I think I might. At 23, bet on television or movies. Don't worry, I'm not 23. I'm just a preternaturally youthful 73. But I still like novels.
Thank God you're not 23, because we want more novels if you don't
mind. Well, you get more novels.
That would be good.
I love novels best. There's no question. I don't have to even ask myself that. But I was very lucky in the case of my first novel, which was never made into a film, but the experience of writing that first novel as a screenplay with a very good director who knew how to write screenplays, he taught me how. Mm. And at the time, the experience of not having that film made at that age, I was a young man. It was my first book. It was my first screenplay. At the time, it felt very bitter. But he showed me a trick, and I learned it. And later, when there was another of my novels I wanted to try, Cider House, I really owed a debt to that first experience. An almost two-year enterprise. We were supported to do it, and then the plug was pulled on us. But that was for 2 years I was a willing apprentice to a great old guy who showed me how.
Does anybody want to ask John any questions about this, about either screenwriting or novel writing or anything, while we've got a little bit of time? And if you do, there's a roving microphone knocking around, so you've got to wait till you get it, otherwise you won't be able to hear a word.
A roving microphone?
Somewhere.
What does that look like?
It's not roving on its own.
Oh, okay. All right.
This is England.
Oh, all right. I
we're not there yet.
I was anxious for
a minute. Anybody got a question?
I just wonder, how far is your work? You have mentioned dreams a few times. How far is your work informed or inspired, or you take something from your dreams into your work?
Truly, I can't think of one example.
Because there's a lot of dreams in Avenue of Mysteries, aren't there?
There are indeed a lot of dreams in Avenue of Mysteries. I don't know if you feel this way, but I always... Because I dream for a living, because my novels are largely a kind of daydreaming experience of worst-case scenarios. What if this happened? Yeah, but what if that happened after this happened? And what if she didn't know that happened? It's because my work day is making up nightmares, to be frank. Well, I always feel very angry about dreaming. I try to wake up. I try to wake up and stop it. I think, God, I mean, enough already. You know, I do it all day. Why, you know? So I have a very I'm very impatient about my dreams. My first wife had the well, for me, unfortunate quality of holding me accountable for how I behaved in her dreams. which I thought was really unfair. You know, really unfair. So maybe that was somewhat tarnished my ability to appreciate or enjoy my own dreams. The short answer would have been, no, not ever.
That was a good question. Thank you. We got another question. Now it's getting exciting. There's a gentleman there. Look, it's a male.
Bless you. But he's young, you see.
He's young. So.
How does your process of writing dialogue change for screenplay and for fiction?
Well, I don't think it does change. I feel very grateful to the process of learning how to write film scripts. I feel very grateful that it made me pay closer attention to the dialogue in my novels. I think the dialogue in my novels really benefited from that 2-year-long experience of learning to write a screenplay with Erwin Kirschner in Vienna. And I could feel that my attention to the dialogue in my fiction was improved by that experience. But I think dialogue has to work in and of itself, both in a film and in a novel. You can't make dialogue do the work of exposition, do the work of description. You can't let the dialogue be the landscape painting equivalent of what you should be doing in your prose. And maybe because my childhood experience was more in the theater and acting, you know, the lessons of dialogue in the theater were that this is not about the information in what the dialogue says. The dialogue is characterization. The dialogue is to enforce and expand on creating the character of the person speaking it. And, you know, that's a theatrical axiom, but I think it applies to novels too. So I don't see a difference there.
I hope you've all written that down. Yes, behind there, there's a lady there.
I really enjoyed the book Fourth Hand, and I wondered where you got the idea from.
Well, the Fourth Hand is the only novel I wrote that was my wife's idea.
She made up for the dream one.
You know, credit where credit is due, and it's also quite different from most of my novels, in that what we started talking about, how important some crucial event in the childhood or adolescence of a character is, how formative that event is in making them the adult they become. Well, the Fourth Hand is quite separate from the rest of my novels in that Wallingford almost doesn't have a childhood. And that's one reason that novel is also among the shortest novels I've ever written. But it was not, by the way, the wife who blamed me for her dreams. It was my wife now who's right here. So I hope I get this right. One night I was brushing my teeth and came back into the bedroom, and she'd been watching something on television which I didn't see. But it had greatly affected her. She looked a little teary. Something awful, I thought, might have happened in the news. I didn't know what had happened. And she had seen a piece on the television news about one of the earliest, at the time, successful hand transplant surgeries. And she told me that if I died, she hoped that she could donate my hands or one of my hands to someone else who needed a hand. Well, this, I don't know about you, but this had never happened to me right after I brushed my teeth and thought I was going to bed and sound asleep. And it was a very disturbing idea. I said, you want, if I'm dead, you want my hand, want another guy to have my hand. And she said, well, yes, then I could at least be with your hand and hold your hand occasionally. Well, of course, you know, like most jealous men, I wasn't thinking about the hand. I was thinking, well, she wants to be with some other guy who's wearing my hand, right? So it was very, yeah. I found it very disturbing. But she thought that, you know, that this was, well, it was a testimony. And then she went to bed. Janet went to bed and promptly went to sleep. I was up all night. You know, I was up all night thinking, what terrible things can go wrong with this premise? Whose hand is it, and where's it going to end up? And what's going to become of that couple? And so that novel had, most of my novels do not have an overnight inspiration. That's another reason they're long. But this one did. The thought of this was, you know, which Janet had said to me out of love, filled me, as many things do, with terror. So that's how it happened, you know.
I think are we at the end now, John?
I think we should.
I think we're at the end.
I think we should call it a day with that.
Thank you so much. And I hope now that you will give us that Manchester round of applause and whoops and whistles and whatever else you fancy for John Irvin. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.